High Tide, John P. Marquand. Sometimes, in the sultry warmth of summer at Deer Bottom, Scott Matey could remember the high tide. And sometimes, when he was feeling in the mood, he might even tell of how he went through a hostile country to find an army which was lost, and how the Battle of Gettysburg might have been wholly different if his horse had not gone lame. At such an hour after his second glass, the old man would sit straighter at the table, and his voice, slightly cracked but soft and gently drawling, would rise above the whirring of the moths which kept fluttering around the guttering candles like incarnations of the quiet sounds from the warm, dark night outside.
"You follow me, gentlemen," he would say. "I'm referring, of course, to the lack of cavalry in the opening phases of that engagement. Cavalry, the eyes and ears, and I'm referring above all to the temporary absence, and I maintain the just and unavoidable absence, of our cavalry general on whose staff I had the honor of serving. I'm referring to that immortal hero gentleman, Major General Jeb Stuart. Beauty Stuart, in the Army of Northern Virginia in the Confederate States of America, the very greatest cavalry commander in that army, gentlemen, which, of course, is the same as saying the greatest cavalry leader in the history of the world."
He meant no exaggeration when he said it. Some impression had been left upon him which transcended time. He would smile beneath his drooping white mustache as though he had a secret, and he had the secret of his days. Strange, unrelated moments were flitting before him like the shadows of the moths upon the wall. Plumed hats, boots of yellow leather that came above the knee, girls snipping buttons off gray coats, eggnogs, Virginia hams, black boys dancing the buck and wing beneath the lantern light. A kiss, a lock of hair, the Bower, Frederick, Winchester, high tide.
"High tide," he said. "It was all an accident and time."
It was clear what he was thinking, although his words had a way of wandering when his mind was groping in the mazes of his vanished world. He was going back to the hours when the tide of the Confederacy lapped over the Potomac to reach its high water mark of the war. He was thinking of Rouser's Ford and the captured wagon train at Cooksville, twisted iron rails, staggering horses, men reeling in the saddle, drunk with sleep. He was thinking of a spy and of Stuart's last great raid. The Army of Northern Virginia was pouring into Pennsylvania. Lee and Longstreet were arguing over plans.
"Sammy," he said to the cook's small boy, "bring some refreshment to the gentleman. Now, Gettysburg. Of course we should have whipped him if Stuart had been there. I should have fetched him, yes, indeed. If that horse had not gone lame near East Berlin, why, surely I'd have fetched him. If I had not stopped by the stone house near the road. A matter of a spy, you understand. A foul, ugly matter. I share in the responsibility, gentlemen. It all was accident and time."
He did not add that he had nearly died in cold blood in that square stone house. He could see the beginning, and he knew that the hand of fate was in it, though it happened more than 60 years ago. Stuart had been stroking his fine brown beard, as he did when he was troubled. It was in the cool of an early summer morning, the first day of July. The horses' heads were drooping, and faces were blank from lack of sleep.
"Matey," Stuart was saying, "I'm lost. Early's gone. Everybody's gone. I've sent off 3 officers already. You go out, too, and find the army. You see this map? We're here. Ride out toward that place, Gettysburg, yonder. Keep riding till you find it."
It was a fine day, he could remember. The fields were green and fresh from early summer, and the land was richer than the land at home. It was a country of fine, rolling fields of pasture and wheat and corn, of neat hedges, neat houses, and compact, ungenerous trees. It was a land uncompromising in its plenty, without warmth of welcome. But the dead weight of weariness was what he remembered best. After 2 days of steady march, men were lying exhausted with bridles in hands, watching horses that stood too tired to eat. There was food in the Yankee wagons they had taken. He could see the white tops of the wagons down the road, but there were many too tired for food. Scott Mate was made of iron and rawhide then, but he was very tired. "The army, sir?" he said. "Which army, sir?" His question made Stuart laugh, and the sound of it came back across the years. He was in a hostile country with his column too tired to move. He was lost, and he was worried, and he had not slept an hour in the last 3 days. Yet the general seemed to feel none of the lethargy of exhaustion. The way he wore his sash, the tilt of the plume in his hat, the angle of his cloak about one shoulder made his equipment look as fresh as when he had started. Nothing ever wilted in the general.
"Which army?" he said. "Well, I'm not aiming to encounter federal troops in force this minute. I'd prefer to meet the Army of Northern Virginia, General Robert E. Lee commanding, now engaged in invasion of Pennsylvania and due to end this war. I'm out of touch, and I don't like it, not right now. They're somewhere over there. Somewhere."
He waved his arm toward the southwest, but there was no dust or smoke or sound. Nothing but open, rolling fields stretching to the horizon in the tranquil light of early morning. The very peace was like a disturbing suspicion that something had gone wrong. It could only have been anxiety that made Stuart speak so frankly.
"The corps should be coming together," he said, "and we should be in front. There should be word, you understand. Your horse all right?"
Scott's horse was a light sorrel caked with sweat and dust.
"He's worn down, sir," said Scott, "but he's as good as any in the column, I reckon, sir."
"Take your blankets and saddle off," Stuart said. "Kill him if you have to, but report to General Lee, you understand. Ask for orders and a new horse to take you back."
"Yes, sir," said Scott. "Where will I find you, sir?"
"We're resting here 2 hours," said Stuart. "Then we're moving on to Carlisle. Watch out for cavalry and don't get caught. We've lost too many on the staff. Goodbye."
Only the impression of small things was left to Scott Mate, and the touch of all the great sights meant much less, until all his memory of camp and bivouac came down to little things. Bodies of men, the sound of marching troops and firing were a part of his life, and were blurred into the monotony of days. But the smell of bacon grease in smoke, a voice or the squeal of a horse would be like yesterday. He remembered how his blankets sprawled over the tailboard of the headquarters wagon, inertly like a dead man's limbs. As they did so, he had a glimpse of fine gray cloth among them. It was his new uniform coat, which he had planned to wear in Washington City, certain they would take Washington. An impulse made him put it on, which was composed of various thoughts, the idea that he might never wear it through accident or theft, the desire to appear in an enemy country like a gentleman, and the conviction that a staff officer should look his best. The coat had the buff facings of the staff. Though it was wrinkled and still damp from a wetting in the Potomac, it was very well cut. He strapped his belt over it with his saber and his pistol, a fine ivory-handled weapon which he had taken from a Yankee colonel in Centerville. His saddle was a Yankee saddle, even his horse had a U.S. brand, but his coat was Richmond, bought with $250 of his country's notes.
"You, Jerry," he said to the horse, "step on. We're bound to go."
Then he remembered that the animal sighed almost exactly like a man. He went down the road past the picket at a trot, and half a mile farther on he met a patrol, riding back. He knew the officer. He was Travis Green from Maryland, and Scott had always liked him.
He liked the way he handled horses. There was something in him which Scott had always trusted, a candor, a vein of sympathy.
"Trav," he said, "seen anything out there?"
Trav shook his head and grinned. The corners of his thin mouth wrinkled.
"No," he answered. "Where you heading?"
"Message," said Scott.
"Seems like the general's getting nervous," Trav said. "Nothing but the staff with messages. You won't get far on that old croc of yours. He's powerful near through."
"Why, boy," said Scott, "this animal can go a week and never drop. Why, he just craves to run. Why, boy, you never seen a raid. This is only trifling up to now."
"Where we heading?" the other asked. "I reckon you don't know."
Scott felt the importance of his knowledge and smiled.
"Don't you wish you knew?" he said. "Where Beauty Stewart wants, that's where. Come to think of it, seems to me you're always asking questions."
"Saucy, aren't you?" said Trav. "I reckon you're out calling in that new coat of yours. I'd take you for a damn Yank if it wasn't for that coat."
"Would you?" said Scott. "Well, you ask Beauty Stewart where I'm going. No doubt he'd just delight to tell you and call for your advice. I'll be seeing you. Goodbye."
Then, almost without thinking, he pulled his watch from his breeches pocket. It was a fine, heavy repeater.
"You, Trav," he called. "Keep this, and if I don't get back, send it on to Deer Bottom, and I'll be much obliged."
He could still hear their voices, low and pleasant, and could recall the way Trav started as he reached and caught the watch.
"To Deer Bottom? Certain sure. I'm proud of your confidence," he said. "Goodbye."
Scott Matey loosened his revolver in its holster and put his horse to a trot again. Not fast, for he had to save the animal's strength, and the horse was tired.
"You, Jerry," he said, "take your time."
Then, as he spoke the word, he knew that he had made a blunder. He had $300 in Confederate bills in his pocket, which would have been more useful at Deer Bottom than a watch. And now, because of a sentimental impulse, he had no way of judging the distance he was traveling, except by instinct and the sun. He knew that one could conceivably ride all day through an opposing army with a good horse and a knowledge of the road. He had seen enough in the raids around McClellan and Pope to have gained a contempt for Yankee horsemanship. He could get safe away from a regiment of Yankee cavalry. But now he could detect a difference. He had been in a friendly country on other rides alone, where there had been a careless tangle of woods and grown-over fields. Friendly people had waved to him. Girls had brought him milk. His horse beneath him had been like a reservoir of untapped strength. But now his horse was tired. There was no spring in the trot, nor a trace of willingness to increase the pace, and the country itself was foreign. There was a plenty in Pennsylvania fields, like the rolling land along the Shenandoah, but there was no generosity in that plenty. There was the same sinister threat in the meticulous furrows and the abundance of that earth which he had seen in the armies that sprang from it. There was a menace in that hostile land, for everything was watching him. He could feel a hatred in that country rising against him like a wave. The sun, glinting on the windows of small farmhouses, made those windows look like eyes reflecting the hatred of unseen faces staring towards the road. And the uncertainty of time was weighing on him because he did not know the time. The uncertainty made him remember Stuart's own uncertainty. "Time," the hoofbeats of his horse were saying, and the humming of the insects and the rustling of the corn were speaking of that flowing, unseen principle which connected life and death. A sound made him draw his reins, and his horse stopped, obedient and still. It came, a swift, metallic click, from behind a clump of small trees near a bend which shut out his vision to the right. His revolver was cocked in his hand while he sat staring, listening. He did not know that he was speaking until he heard his voice.
"Pshaw,"
he heard himself mutter. A man in overalls was hoeing a potato patch just around the bend. He turned and stared at Scott.
"Morning, friend," said Scott. "It looks like a right fine morning."
The man spat on a potato hill.
"I ain't no friend of yourn," he said, "nor any of your kind."
Scott laughed.
"Why, mister," he said, "I mean you no harm, and that's why I say friend. I only aim to ask you if you can let me know the time."
"Would it give you comfort," the other asked, "if you was to know the time?"
"Why, surely," Scott said, still smiling. "I'd like right well to know."
The man's voice became louder.
"Then I'll die before I tell you, you N-word trading thief."
"Two of my sons has died, and I can die before I raise a hand to give one mite of comfort to your lot. I only hope your time is short, and I may see your carcass rotting. Now get on."
Scott Matey put his horse to the trot and hurried down the road, amazed. He saw other men pause to gaze at him from the roadside. Women stared from doorways. Children, when they saw him, ran screaming. He did not stop again to ask the time. He did not stop again until his horse went lame. By then a high forenoon sun was beating on his plumed felt hat, and the farming country lay before him as beautiful as a picture, incongruously far from war. The horse went lame so suddenly you might have thought he had been shot, a stumble, a sharp snort of pain, and he was limping. After Scott Matey was off the saddle, it did not take half a minute to convince him that his horse was through, and, though he had grown callous to the suffering of animals, he felt a pang of sorrow. The road, he remembered, was sloping down to a ford across a brook. Beyond the ford, it wound up again past a rutted lane, which led to a square house of deep gray limestone, set back perhaps 100 yards from the roadway. That house on its little rise of ground always came back to his memory as aloofly pleasant. Heavy chimneys, small-paned windows, a fine arched doorway of an earlier time. It always seemed to him to speak of kindliness and of sober, decent lives, and to be without a taint of anything sinister or bizarre. A long cattle barn stood behind the house, flanked by young apple trees set in even rows. He looked for half a minute, then hooked the bridle through his arm, walking slowly with his limping horse.
"Jerry," he said, "I'm going to leave you yonder."
The windows were blank and impassive as he walked up the lane, and everything was silent. Too silent.
"Hello," he called. "Is anybody home?"
The sound of his voice was like the breaking of a spell. Two shepherd dogs rushed at him, snarling. A door had slammed, and an old man ran towards them with a stick, a picture of towering strength, half worn away by age. A white shirt, bare, scrawny arms, and a fine white beard halfway down his chest, but his height was what Scott remembered best. He was very tall.
"Grandpa,"
he heard a child's voice calling from the house.
"Don't take on so, Grandpa. You'll have another bad turn if you do."
The noise of the dogs seemed to ebb away. All his memory of the barnyard seemed to ebb away, leaving only that figure of age, something never to forget. The old man was breathing much too heavily. His shirt and heavy knit suspenders and baggy trousers took nothing from his dignity. Something in his face made his beard like ashes over glowing coals, a mobile, powerful face. His forehead was high. His eyes were serene and steely blue. Scott Matey took off his hat and bowed, though the man was plain and not a gentleman.
"I'm intrudin', sir," he said. "My horse, he's broken down. I reckon that—"
"Mary Breen," the old man shouted. "You Mary Breen?"
A girl, she could not have been above 13, came rushing from the house. Her gingham dress, her face and eyes, had a washed-out look. Her bleached yellow pigtails were slapping on her shoulders.
"Mary Breen," the old man said, "put up that horse. I made haste, as I always will, to serve the Lord. Young man, you come with me. This is a day of glory."
Scott Matey stared at him, bewildered for a moment.
"Put up that horse," the old man said, "and put the saddle on the bay that's waiting. You'll need another horse for sure. Now please, follow me."
Surely, sir, said Scott. With great pleasure. I'll be pleased to settle for another animal, of course. Excuse me, could you let me know the time?
He had no premonition on entering the house. He had seen enough peculiar people and places in that war. The tide of war had pushed him into mean kitchens and stables for a night, or just as strangely it had whirled him into dining rooms of plantation houses, where he had touched on lives which he would never touch again. He did not bother to put an implication to the old man's words, except that they were friendly. The friendliness brought back Scott's confidence in inevitable fortune, and he straightened his sash and dusted off his coat.
Yes, the old man said again, this is a day of glory. I'm glad I've lived to see it, because I'm getting old.
The kitchen was very neat. A kettle was humming on the stove so that the steam made the air humidly pleasant. There were two strong wooden chairs and a deal table, but what he noticed first was the asthmatic, hurried ticking of a clock above the humming of the boiling water. He turned to glance at it where it stood on a shelf between two windows, a dingy clock in a veneered mahogany case. He could shut his eyes and see it still. The hour was just 11.
No, the old man said, not here. The parlor's just this way.
He had opened a door to the front entry, and Scott began to smile, amused by the formality which led him to the parlor. He had a glimpse of himself in the entry mirror. His face was thin and brown, and his coat, he was pleased to notice, fitted very well.
Here you be, the old man said, and we give thanks you're here.
He opened the parlor door as he spoke, and Scott had a whiff of fresh cigar smoke and a blurred vision of a horsehair sofa and of faded floral wallpaper. But he only half saw the room. For a second, the time could not have been long, he stood on the threshold stonily. A saber and a revolver were lying on the parlor table, and behind the table, smoking a cigar, his coat half unbuttoned and his black hat slouched over his eyes, a federal major was sitting. In that instant of surprise, Scott could think of nothing. A sharp nose and deep brown eyes, florid cheeks, a drooping black mustache half covering a lantern jaw, clean linen, dark blue broadcloth, gold on the shoulders.
Howdy, Captain James, the major said. I saw you from the window. I'm from you know where. Let's get down to business. I've got a way to ride. Do you want to see my papers?
No, said Scott. His voice was hoarse. No, Major.
No doubt about you, the Major said. New coat, Yankee saddle, Yankee boots. You've got your nerve to go among 'em so, and by gad, you're young to be in a game like this.
The Major was watching him curiously, but not suspiciously, beneath the brim of his black hat, and Scott Mate had learned to read the capabilities of an individual. Something told him that this officer was an accurate and dangerous man. The Major's hand, with thick, blunt fingers, was resting on the table just 6 inches away from his pistol butt. Scott could see it from the corner of his eye, and he could notice 4 notches cut in the black walnut of the butt, telling him in silent voices that the chances were the Major would shoot him dead if he made a sudden move. Scott was standing in the doorway, with the old man just behind him. If he should make a move to draw his weapon before his pistol was out of the holster, he knew he would be dead.
A dirty game, the Major said, with his cigar between his teeth. A thankless game. You should be more careful, Captain. Your uniform's too new.
Scott Mate was not a fool. He knew, if he had not known before, what he was supposed to be and why the Major was waiting.
Thank you, sir, said Scott, and he contrived a smile.
A little talk, a word, a gesture, and he might have a chance to snatch that pistol from the table.
I agree, sir. It's a right dirty business, and I detest a scout. But, excuse me, we'd better be alone.
It would help to get the old man out. He turned slowly until their eyes met. The old man's eyes were as blue as a china plate at home, and he heard the Major laughing.
Don't worry about Pa Breen, he said. He's as straight as string. Father, you go out and close the door.
Young man, old Mr. Breen said, don't fret about me none. I can die for a cause as good as you, I guess. Amen.
When he closed the door, there was no sound outside in the entry, but the farmer must have had the tread of an Indian because 5 seconds later, Scott heard the kitchen door slam shut.
The old man's cracked, the major said. You know, one of those fanatic abolitionists, agent in the underground, friend of Garrison and Whittier, leader of the party hereabouts. Why, he'd kill a man in gray as easily as he'd stick a pig, and he's in the butcher business. They had to hide his pants so he wouldn't go to Harper's Ferry with Brown.
Yes, sir, said Scott. It's been my observation that he's a right smart old man.
The major tapped his fingers on the table, but some perversity kept them close to the revolver butt.
Mad, said the major. Ideas drive men mad when ideas and religion mix. What's your notion of their strength, James? Sit down. There's a chair.
Scott Matey drew his chair carefully to the opposite side of the table. Being an officer of the staff, he had heard enough rumors and secrets to enable him to twist them plausibly into lies. It surprised him how quickly his mind was working and as smoothly as his voice.
Major, said Scott, Moss Bob. He has a heap of men. Reserves have been drawn from the state garrisons. I'm safe saying General Lee's across the river with 110,000. It's high tide.
He tossed out the number glibly, though he knew he was naming twice the strength. He did so from his knowledge of the Yankee obsession of superior numbers, and he saw that his guess was right. The major whistled softly.
You're high, he said. I hope. Can you name the strength of corps?
He had never thought of the meaning of information until he sat there waiting for the Yankee major to move his hand. As he spoke, he could think of armies moving like blind monsters, each groping towards the other to the tune of lies like this. He paused and leaned a trifle across the table.
Major, he said, have you another of those cigars? I'm perishing for a smoke.
He gathered his feet under him noiselessly. He could not sit there talking. If he could make the major move his hand, he could push the table over.
Beg pardon,
the major said, and reached with his left hand inside his coat and tossed a leather case across the table.
A light?
The major pushed across a silver match safe, still with his left hand.
Believe me, your information's worth a box of these cigars.
A tap on the door made him stop. It was the little girl with the bleached pigtails. She was carrying 2 glasses and a small stone jug.
Why, said Scott Matey. Hello, honeybee.
Grandpop, said the little girl. He said to fetch you this.
Set it on the floor, the major said, and close the door behind you. We're not thirsty, sister.
Grandpop, said the little girl. He don't touch it since he was took with spells. Something appears to get a hold of him, like a rope across the chest. First a pain under his arm, like, and then across the chest.
You tell your grandpop to take a pill, the major said, and go out and close the door.
The major leaned back in his chair. His deliberation set Scott's nerves on edge, but the major did not move his hand.
Well, he said, it's a quaint, strange world. Here you and I are sitting, smoking good Havanas. There an old man is took with spells, and somewhere else 2 armies are jockeying for position. Suppose they ran into each other blind, neither of them ready. War's like walking in the dark.
Believe me, sir,
Scott said, and he half forgot what he was supposed to be.
Robert E. Lee is never in the dark. He's the greatest man alive.
You've got the cant, said the major, but you don't believe that, do you? Where's his cavalry? Off with Stuart when it should be in front of his army. Either Lee or Stuart's a plain fool.
Scott Matey half rose from his chair and sat down again. Just in time, he remembered where he was.
Yes, sir,
the major was saying, as though he were reading from a textbook.
Cavalry should form a screen in front of any army of invasion, as any pleb knows at the point, instead of being detached on a needless mission, moving northwest when the main body's 30 miles south.
Then Scott Matey forgot and spoke before he thought.
Here, he said sharply. How did you know that?
The major's head went forward. His eyes were suddenly sharp.
Why, you sent us word from Hanover yourself.
Hanover,
said Scott, but the major was not listening. At last he had raised his right hand from the table.
Hush,
the major said.
Hush. Listen.
For a second, Scott forgot the hand. The major had good ears. Through the closed windows, Scott became conscious of what the major heard, though it was not a sound exactly. It was rather a very faint concussion, a stirring in the air which might have been summer thunder if the sun were not shining. Even in the parlor, Scott could feel its strength.
I hear 'em. Guns, he said.
Though the major was looking at him, his eyes were blank from listening.
Yes, he said. A scad of guns. We've struck into something heavy. There, you hear?
Scott could hear, and he could see. In that same instant, the officer turned his head towards the direction of the sound, and then Scott moved. He was very quick in those days, when a sudden motion might make the difference between life and death. That Yankee moved also, but he was not fast enough. Scott had snatched the pistol up, and he was stepping backward.
Here, you, the major shouted. Set that down.
Mr. Major, Scott told him, you'll step backward from that table and keep down your voice if you want to save your skin. That's better, Major. You've told me something right valuable. General Stuart will be pleased to know he's got a spy out with him. I'll be surprised if that spy keeps living long.
The major was a cool man. He leaned against the wall, twisting an end of his mustache and speaking in a careful nasal drawl.
All right for now, the major said. But you listen to me, staff officer. A spy's more valuable than you or me. I hope you realize I'll do my best to stop you if I can.
Scott smiled back at him.
I realize, he said. That's why I beg of you to stand right still. If there's a battle yonder, I'm going to it, Mr. Major, and your horse is going with me.
You've got a most consoling voice, the major said.
Put your hands above your head,
said Scott. Then he knew that there was something wrong. The major's eyes had narrowed, and he was looking across Scott's shoulder towards the little parlor door.
Certainly, the major said. Don't get excited, Johnny.
There was a creak of a floorboard behind him. He remembered the impulse to turn and the certainty that something was just behind him, but almost with the impulse, a weight landed on his back and he was pitching forward. Scott fired just as he was falling so that the crash of the shot and the smell of black powder blended with a taste of sulfur in his mouth. Someone had him by the throat. He kicked to free himself, but someone held his legs.
Tie his hands, he heard the major say. Steady. He's all right.
He was choking. Flashes of searing light were darting across his eyes.
Breen?
Another voice was speaking, a soft southern voice.
Take your hands off him. We've got him all right now.
Then he was struggling to his feet. His hands were tied behind him, and he noticed that a cloud of powder smoke was rising softly towards the ceiling. There was a haze before his eyes and a drumming in his ears.
Scott?
Someone was saying.
I'm right sorry it is you.
The haze was lifting like a curtain until he could see the room again. The major was perhaps 4 feet away, lighting another of his cigars. Old Breen, with one of his braces snapped, leaned against the table. Scott could hear the old man's breath.
Hush, hush,
it seemed to say.
Hush, hush.
There was a fourth man in the room, in Confederate uniform. Scott felt a wave of nausea as he saw him. The man was Travis Green, whom he had met that very morning.
Johnny, the major said, you stand still.
So it's you, Trav, is it? Scott Matei was saying. The other cleared his throat, looked at Scott, and then away.
Scott, he said, I reported to the general your horse looked mighty bad. He sent me on to follow you. I was looking for a chance to get away. Scott, I'm sorry it should be you.
Scott Matei answered duly.
Trav, he said, I won't say what I think.
I reckon I don't mind, said Green. That's part of it.
Scott drew in his breath. The old man's breath, with its wheezing haste, was all that disturbed him.
Trav, he said, you better keep out of our lines if once I get away.
Scott, said Green again, it makes me sick it's you.
Then the major was speaking impersonally, almost kindly.
Listen, Johnny, I'd take you back as prisoner if I dared to run the risk, but we're too close to rebel cavalry for anything like that. This officer,
he waved his cigar slowly and was careful with his words,
this officer is going back where he's useful, son. You see my point? There's no hard feeling in it. You and I don't amount to shucks. This officer is going back, and there must be no, chance of your going. See my point?
Scott moistened his lips.
I understand, he said. Well, I'd be pleased if you get it over with. Perhaps we'd all be pleased.
There was silence. He heard Green start to speak and stop. The old man's breathing was easier. He became aware that the old man was watching him with his steady light blue eyes.
Gentlemen, said Grandpa Breen, you leave this year to me. There's been enough goings-on to attract attention. I'll gladly mind this year.
There was no doubt of his meaning or any doubts that the major took his meaning. The major was buttoning his coat with steady, rapid fingers.
There's a time, the old man said, and a place for everything under the sun. Take him to the kitchen and tie him to the hickory chair. I'll fetch rope.
Major, said Green, you take him.
Oh, the major said, let's get out of this. Come on.
The major was a good hand with the ropes. He lashed Scott to the kitchen chair so efficiently that there was no chance of moving. Just above his head, where he could not see it, the clock was ticking and the kettle was bubbling on the stove. Once he was alone, he found himself searching the pine floor for a speck of dust. They were in the parlor talking. He could hear the murmur of their voices.
Soon it's dark, he heard the old man say.
Major, he shouted. Hear you, Major.
The door from the entry opened, he remembered, and the major stood there pulling on his gloves.
Johnny, he said, you keep your nerve.
Yes, sir, said Scott. I've got my nerve. I simply wish to ask you, are you leaving me alone?
Yes, the major said. Johnny, keep your nerve.
Their glances met, but only for a fraction of a second, as though they saw something indecent in each other's eyes.
I'm not letting your friend come in, the major said.
You tell him goodbye, said Scott.
Goodbye, the major said. I should have shot you, Johnny, when you were rolling on the floor.
Then the kitchen door opened, letting in warm air that was sweet with the scent of hay. Old Mr. Breen, still in his shirt sleeves, was standing in the doorway with a shovel in his hand. The homeliness of the kitchen and the peaceful warmth from outdoors made everything grotesque.
Brother, said Mr. Breen to the major, the horses are ready. You'd best be getting on. And you, young man, I wish you no pain, but I know what you are figuring. It won't do no good to holler. No one'll hear who cares. It won't do no good to tip over in the chair. I made it. It won't break. But I'll be near if you should call.
Scott Matei did not speak again, and the door slammed shut. He tried to move, but he was as helpless as a hog tied by the legs.
First, the dogs were yelping, and then there was a sound of hoofs outside the door, and then the place was still except for the humming of the kettle and the ticking of the clock, and in back of everything was that almost soundless vibration of cannon a long way off. He closed his eyes, but even when he closed them, he could see Mr. Breen. He had no proper sense of sequence, for his mind was like a sick man's, but there was one thing in his thoughts Scott Matey remembered. He could not divide an hour from the next when his mind was carrying him to 100 places. Bits of his life would whirl about him. He was shooting wild turkey at Deer Bottom. He was with the cavalry again. But there was one thing on his mind. He must not let the old man know that he was in deathly fear. The light was growing softer outside the kitchen windows when the kitchen door opened again and Mr. Breen came in. Clay was smeared on his hands and over his gaunt, bare arms. He walked past the chair and began washing at the kitchen sink.
"Young man," said Mr. Breen, "do you need water?"
"No," said Scott. "So you're going to kill me, mister?"
The old man walked in front of him with a clean towel in his hands.
"Yes," he said. "I'm the Lord's poor instrument. Young man, are you afraid?"
"No," said Scott. "But if I were you, I reckon I'd be afraid."
Old Mr. Breen stared down at him and began to wipe his hands.
"Did your people fear?"
he asked.
"When they sent an anointed saint to heaven?"
"Mister," said Scott, and he kept his voice even, "I'd be pleased to know for the comfort of my mind when you propose to kill me."
"After dark,"
said Mr. Breen.
"I don't aim to lug you out for burial in daylight. I'm pleased you ain't afraid. I ain't afraid, and I'll die presently. There's something gets me here."
Suddenly his eyes were childlike, Scott remembered. He was drawing his hand across his chest.
"Mister," said Scott quickly, "I've seen a heap of illnesses. Step here and show me where."
"Young man," said Mr. Breen, "I can read your mind, I guess. You want to tip your chair and yourself atop me. No, young man, I'll be going, but I'll be ready in case you call."
The light outside the kitchen windows was growing soft and mellow, and he could hear the cannon. The time was going past him like a flood again, leaving him motionless like a rock against that flow. For a long while he was entirely alone. As the dusk came down, he heard the lowing of the cows and the clatter of the milk pails which had stood beside the barn. It must have been when the old man had started milking that the little girl came in through the doorway from the entry. The door squeaked and opened just a crack at first.
"Why, hello, honeybee," said Scott. "Come in. Don't go away. Surely I can't hurt you, honeybee."
She came tiptoeing towards him. He did not blame her for being frightened.
"Honeybee," he said.
The child was not attractive, but he could see she liked the name.
"I'm powerful thirsty. Could you fetch a cup of water from the sink?"
"I'm scared,"
the little girl whispered.
"Why, shucks," said Scott. "You scared a saucy girl like you? You fetch that cup now, honeybee. Isn't your grandpop milking? How'll he know? There, and I've got something for you in my coat. Just ease this rope off my hand so I can reach."
"No,"
she whispered.
"I'm too scared."
He could hear his own voice still, not like his own, with its undercurrent of appeal beneath its ridiculous pretense at playfulness, as he pleaded for his life. He was ashamed of that moment, always, his begging from a child so that one hand could be free.
"I dasn't,"
she whispered, but he knew better. She would dare because there was something inside his coat. All the repression of her life gleamed in her pale blue eyes in little points of light.
"Honeybee," said Scott, "it's something mighty fine, something you won't guess."
There was no sound which made him look up, but he had the sense that there was something different in the gathering of the dusk. The dusk seemed to settle over him like a blanket thrown about his head. He looked up to see the old man standing in the doorway, watching.
There was something in the way he stood that made Scott sure that he had planned that scene for his own pleasure. He must have been there for several minutes, as inevitable as the figure with the hourglass and the scythe.
"Mary Breen," the old man said, "you step away. Now, Mary Breen, you fetch the papers by the woodbox. So, now lay 'em on the floor around the chair, under it. You'd best lay on some more. And now go up to your chamber and close your door tight shut."
They were silent for a while. Old Mr. Breen seemed taller in the dark, more like an immense abstraction than a man.
"It's getting dark," he said. "Young man, I'll leave you 5 minutes to say your prayers."
He turned on his heel silently, walked out and closed the door.
"Time," the clock was whispering. "Time."
Inside the stove, a piece of wood snapped sharply. He could see the glow of coals through the lids on top. The homely smells of the kitchen came round him in a rush. He strained sideways at his ropes, and the heaviness of his breathing drowned every other sound.
"Help!"
he shouted. The dogs in the yard began to bark so that his shout mingled with the wave of barking.
"Help!"
he shouted.
"Murder!"
He hitched forward and the chair fell forward, throwing him head first into the dusk whiteness of the paper on the floor. The blow on his head must have stunned him, but he could not have been out long. There was still a little daylight when he found himself lying sideways, still lashed to the kitchen chair.
"Mr. Soldier,"
someone was calling.
"You hear me, Mr. Soldier?"
It was the little girl in the gingham dress again.
"Yes," he said. "I hear you, honeybee."
"It's Grandpop,"
she was sobbing.
"He's took again. He's flopped flat down right on the parlor floor. When you hollered, he flopped down."
"You'll get a knife and cut me loose," said Scott. "I reckon I can help your Grandpop then."
"Mister,"
she sobbed.
"Please, you won't hurt him."
"No," he answered. "I won't hurt him."
Once he was loose, his arms and legs were useless for a while. They burned and ached, once the blood came back, until tears stood in his eyes.
"Strike a candlelight," he said, "and help me up. I'm very pressed for time."
He hobbled through the entry. Old Mr. Breen was lying on the parlor floor face up, flat out. The candle which the girl was holding made a frame about the high head and the flowing beard. He was conscious, in great pain, staring up at Scott Matey. Scott's own ivory-handled revolver was lying on the floor where it must have fallen from old Breen's hand. He stooped painfully and picked it up, but for half a minute no one spoke.
"Your heart, sir," said Scott.
He was incomprehensibly courteous and polite, but the old man did not speak.
"Something gets him right across the chest,"
said Mary Breen.
"It pulls him down."
"Set that candle on the table."
Scott was speaking gently. He saw his belt and saber in the corner. He walked over and strapped on his belt.
"Sir,"
he said, still gently,
"I'm sorry to have to leave you in distress, but you and I don't matter. You've a horse in the barn, I recall you saying. I'm leaving you $100 on this table for the horse. I'll call at a neighbor's to send you help. And now, good night."
He was in the barnyard among the snarling dogs holding a stable lantern. There was a heavy smell from hay and from the soft, warm breath of cattle. There was a drumming in his ears like the hurry of a clock.
"Time," it was saying. "Time."
He heard himself speaking to Mary Breen, and then he was mounted and in the yard again. The horse was coarse and wild.
"Excuse me,"
Mary Breen was calling.
"Ain't you forgot? Something in your pocket?"
He pulled out the rest of his bills.
"There," he said. "Take him, honeybee."
He saw the house like a sharp, ungainly blot against the sky where a deep red gash of something burning in the west made the outline clear. As he moved down the lane towards that distant glow, he did not know what he felt or thought, except that he must hurry. But suddenly he leaned forward on the neck of the farm horse. He felt sick, deathly sick. There he was, sitting at his table at Deerbottom, too old by any right to feel the force of memory. The wings of death were hovering near him, but no such death as that. He had consolation from the knowledge he had gained that life was all dirt cheap.
"Only two things," he said, "matter, accident, and time. Now, Gettysburg, all that mattered were accident and time."
His mind was back on the night again. It always seemed to him that most of the Gettysburg affair was night, mistaken roads and Union pickets, and other roads choked by ammunition trains and infantry, and wounded moving back. Two crawling, passing lines. Though the discipline was good, roads were always confused in the rear of a line of battle. There was the vagueness of a dream when one rode at such a time. There was no hope in haste or wishing.
"You come from Stuart?" someone said. "Well, it's too late for cavalry until we drive 'em. Where have you been? We've been fighting here since yesterday."
The night was never clear, but when he saw the leader of the army, that was clear enough. He reported to General Lee at 10:15 in the morning outside a half-demolished house on the outskirts of the town of Gettysburg. Couriers were holding horses and staff officers were standing a few paces back, so that he always thought of the general as entirely alone. He could remember a tall, solitary man with a graying beard and deep, dark eyes whose face was passionless. He was looking, Scott remembered, across a valley of green fields to a long, gentle slope, which was held by the Union lines about 1/2 mile away. He was speaking to a dusty, worried officer, Scott remembered, unhurriedly except for one short gesture, and Scott could hear the words.
"Is he ready to attack, sir?"
"No, sir."
"Very well," the general said. "Hurry back. Tell him he's very late already."
He stared back across the valley as Scott stood waiting. The stones of a cemetery were visible upon the ridge opposite, and an ugly building which would be some sort of school. The ridge was heavy with troops, throwing up lines of earthworks. Beyond were the dust clouds of more troops moving up, and more. That ridge was a fine position which was growing stronger every hour. Now and then there would be a burst of rifle fire, but there was no forward movement. He stood waiting while the general looked, forgetting his fatigue as he watched. Then Scott saw him strike his hands together in a sudden, swift motion, and he heard him say,
"It's too bad. Too bad."
Scott had wished to be somewhere else. He felt like an eavesdropper who had heard a dangerous secret, but the general was turning towards him slowly.
"Well," he said, "what is it, Captain?"
"Captain Matei, sir," began Scott, "from General Stuart's staff."
"Yes,"
the general stopped him.
"When did you leave the general, Captain? How far is he along?"
6 o'clock yesterday morning, sir," said Scott. "General Stuart was at Dover then."
For a moment the general looked at him, and it seemed to Scott that the general was very tired, though his expression did not change.
"Captain," the general said, "you're very late."
Scott felt his face grow red.
"Sir,"
he began, but the general stopped him.
"Never mind," he said. "Of course you were delayed."
"Sir," said Scott, "will the general send me back with orders?"
"No."
The voice was tranquil and very courteous.
"General Stuart has his orders. It's too late to make it better. It would have been too late unless he had come yesterday."
He raised his voice, and Scott knew again that he was thinking of time.
"Colonel, send another officer to General Longstreet to find out his delay. And give this officer food and rest. He's too tired to go on."